From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Wingers of Spring are speeding toward the Goons of June. Ahead on Only a Game, an NHL update. Also a profile of NBA journeyman Jamario Moon, who hopes to stick with the Miami Heat. We'll have an appreciation of Gary Player and his 52 Masters appearances. And hoops opportunities abound at the 7th annual So You Want to Be a Coach Clinic. Also ahead, stocks and sticks intersect, courtesy of a brave young athlete who keeps one foot on Wall Street and the other on a Boston indoor lacrosse floor.
We made a decision that this guy was disciplined enough, and he has kept the candle lit on both ends and held up his end of that bargain. It's not easy on him, but he does his best he can to support both sides of his life.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In Montreal, there's much relief. In Boston, there is joy. The fans throughout Columbus are like children with a toy they've never had before. And I'll explain that simile as I call in the great Helene to talk a while with me. That would be our splendid source for all stuff shot from sticks, except for lacrosse sticks. Helene Elliott of the LA Times. Helene, welcome back to the program.
How do you know I don't know lacrosse?
Well, I don't ask you about lacrosse.
That's an assumption.
We are down to the last weekend of the NHL's regular season. On Thursday, the San Jose Sharks had a chance to clinch the league's best overall record and home ice advantage throughout the playoffs, which begin on Wednesday. They can do that with a win today against Los Angeles, will they?
I can't see why not. They have all this motivation, but you know what? They also have a lot of pressure. And I saw them last week when they played a home-and-home with Anaheim, and I was talking to their general manager, Doug Wilson, and they were saying, you know, you guys really have a lot of pressure this season. And you can see him tense up and go, we don't have any more pressure than usual. It's always the pressure we put on ourselves, which, translation, he's petrified, and so are they. You know, anything less than getting past the second round of the playoffs is going to be considered a failure for them, and rightfully so. I mean, this team has always had a lot of talent. The last few years, there have been a lot of expectations, but they haven't gotten past the second round, and they really need to do that.
On Wednesday, the Columbus Blue Jackets qualified for their first ever playoff berth. I wonder, does this help to establish the city better known for its college football team as a hockey town?
Well, they've done well in terms of attendance. I don't know that they need to change everything. They've created a niche for themselves. I was going to say that they're the only pro sport in town, but Ohio State is pretty near a pro sport right there.
Yeah, you see, their MLS is in town, too.
Oh, excuse me. I'm so sorry. Please forgive me, oh soccer gods. but the Blue Jackets, you know, they're a fun team to watch. Ken Hitchcock, their coach, has a very interesting background. He's coached around the league and big Civil War buff. It's good to see a team like that in a so-called non-traditional market be successful and get into the playoffs.
Are there other Western Conference teams that we should be thinking about and speaking about at this point, vis-a-vis the postseason?
Well, I think the topic going in the West is going to be the Red Wings, who have not been playing well lately, or by their standards. I mean, it's hard to look at a team that has 51 wins. It's like talking about the Lakers and saying, oh, they're not playing well. but you can't measure them against other teams. You have to measure them against what they're capable of themselves. And the Red Wings' goaltending is a very big question going into this. I've heard people saying, gee, if Anaheim plays Detroit, you know, Anaheim's a dangerous team. They could beat Detroit. I'm not ready to say that, but it's going to be interesting to see how the Red Wings handle the goaltending situation in the playoffs.
The Bruins locked up the best record in the Eastern Conference this past week, and they will enjoy home ice advantage through at least the conference finals, should they get that far. But they had a bit of a swoon in March. Is that worrisome?
It's impossible for the length of an NHL season or NBA season to maintain an incredible level for the whole season. It just cannot happen. Travel, winter travel particularly, you know, guys getting colds and flu and that kind of thing. It's just unrealistic to expect there to not be a swoon. The key is, how have they been playing the last week or so? How have they been getting themselves together going into the playoffs? I think that's what you really need to look at as the better indicator.
The Boston Herald reported this week that the third annual Winter Classic outdoor hockey game will be played at Fenway Park here in Boston next New Year's Day. I don't know about you, but I can't wait to see Zdeno Chara blasting 100-mile-per-hour slappers off the green monster in left field.
I think it's a great idea. I love it. I think it's absolutely brilliant. They did a wonderful job at Wrigley Field in the game this year, and Fenway Park is absolutely the natural next. I think it's going to be a terrific, terrific atmosphere.
And then the natural progression sees the 2011 Winter Classic at Dodger Stadium, right?
Why not? The NHL ice guru, Dan Craig, says it can be done. I mean, seriously, I mean, with refrigerated portable rinks, I mean, you know, sit there and drink your piña colada and wearing shorts and flip-flops, and you're good.
On Thursday, the New York Rangers and Montreal Canadiens grabbed the last two available playoff spots in the East. This should energize a couple of long-suffering NHL fan bases, right?
Indeed. Emphasis on suffering, I suppose, for Rangers since 1994. It's as if they're riding a 15-year-ago triumph, and they haven't done a hell of a lot since then. The Canadiens are a really interesting story because they had an incredible start, and everybody was saying, you know, this is their centennial year. This is their year to win the Cup, and no Canadian team has won the Cup in so long. And then they went through a swoon, and they were actually out of the top eight for a little bit. So it's really been a difficult season for the Canadiens, and I'm curious to see how they rebound now. That's going to be worth watching.
Olene Elliott covers sports for the Los Angeles Times, and she is our Lady Luck of the Line Change here on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Olene.
Thank you.
You've probably heard of the Gary Steelheads. No? Well, how about the Huntsville Flight? Certainly you must have followed the Arkansas Rimrockers. These basketball teams might be new to you, but Jamario Moon knows them well. They're just a few of the many squads for which he's played on his long, zigzagging path to the NBA. Only a Game's Doug Tribou reports.
Jamario Moon was born in Goodwater, Alabama, a town with approximately 1,600 residents. Add 18,000 to that number, and you get the attendance at the last Miami Heat home game. At a Friday morning shoot-around, Moon and the Heat are preparing for a game against the Celtics at the TD Bank North Garden in Boston. Moon visits family in Goodwater every off-season and says as the town's first professional athlete, he's a symbol of what's possible.
Everybody's like, man, you opened the door for a lot of the, you know, a lot of the little kids that's coming up. So I'm like, that's what I wanted to do. I wasn't doing what I was doing for me. I was doing it for the next generation.
After high school, the 6'8" forward played one season at Meridian Community College in Meridian, Mississippi. Head coach George Brooks first spotted Moon while scouting a high school game in the late 1990s.
He's just doing things that are just amazing. And you're trying to figure out then how you get him. And they tell you he's just a 10th grader. And it's even more shocking the stuff he's doing.
Brooks says Moon has kept in touch, and people at Meridian have been rooting for him ever since.
He's an easy guy to pull for. I mean, he's got a good heart, he's well-mannered and good-tempered, and he's a guy that, you know, everybody meets as his friend. You know, he's a great guy.
Moon entered the 2001 NBA draft, but was not selected. And that's when his life as a basketball nomad began. Minor league basketball is more loosely organized than its baseball and hockey counterparts. There are several independent leagues with different schedules, allowing some players to play year-round. Along the way, Moon made teams like the Dodge City Legend, the Kentucky Colonels, and the Fort Worth Flyers. In 2004, the Harlem Globetrotters brought him on as a dunking specialist. He even played for Fuerza Regia, a Mexican team. Moon says hopping around from squad to squad never bothered him.
Going from place to place, it didn't matter because I was just like, okay, it's free travel. whatever team I went to, I just made new friends and you know, just tried to leave my mark wherever I went. You know, my mark is being a good person.
Jim Coyne is the general manager of the Albany Patroons, a minor league team in upstate New York. Moon played two stints there from 2005 to 2007. Coyne says the Patroons frequently attract NBA scouts because Albany is close to many Northeastern teams, and several came to see Moon play.
But I tell you what, if this guy was in Mars, they'd find a spaceship and be able to get out there real quick to watch him because he's just a phenomenal player. I'm surprised that it went so long.
Moon was close to making NBA teams a number of times, but in 2007 he got his best shot when the Raptors invited him to a three-day minicamp. Then Toronto head coach Sam Mitchell knew about struggling to make it to the NBA. Before his 13-year career with Minnesota and Indiana, Mitchell spent 5 years playing in the minor leagues and overseas. Toronto Star columnist Dave Feschuk says Mitchell was one of Moon's biggest supporters.
Sam had such a soft spot for DeMario. It probably hurt his judgment a little bit because he kept going with Moon, when maybe it was illogical to keep going with Moon. But on the other hand, he gave Moon a chance that he otherwise wouldn't have gotten. And he gave him a chance to prove himself, which in essence he really did.
Moon made Toronto's 2007-2008 roster. A 27-year-old journeyman player making his big league debut could have easily wound up at the far end of the bench, but he started 75 regular season games. Moon was selected to the NBA's all-rookie second team and participated in the 2008 dunk contest. What was running through his mind when he finally reached the NBA after 6 years in the minors?
I mean, it was just another team for me. I was just like, okay, I'm where I wanted to be, but it's just another team. It's still basketball, so I got to make the most of it so I can stay here.
The Raptors made the playoffs and lost their opening round series to the Orlando Magic, but Moon notched a double-double with 11 points and 10 rebounds in the Raptors' only win. This season, Toronto is out of the playoff race, and the Raptors traded Moon to Miami in February as part of a four-player deal. Miami has already clinched a playoff spot, which means Moon is headed to his second straight postseason. Heat forward James Jones says he's earned it.
You know, a lot of days in the gym working for you know, little or no money, and just playing off of passion. And so it takes a lot of dedication and a strong will to make it. And that's why guys like Jamario, I mean, they're great stories, and they're to be commended for sticking it out.
Moon and the Heat lost to the Celtics Friday night. He's averaging more than 7 points and 4 rebounds a game and will become a restricted free agent at the end of the season. But right now, Moon says he's excited about the Heat's chances in the playoffs, and he believes his perseverance is paying off.
It's hard work. I've been fortunate enough to be put in some good situations. And I mean, hey, we get what we deserve.
For Only a Game, I'm Doug Trabu.
Early Thursday morning, Nick Adenhart, who had pitched 6 scoreless innings for the Los Angeles Angels on Wednesday evening, was killed in a traffic accident in Fullerton, California. The car in which Adenhart was a passenger was struck by a minivan that ran a red light. The driver of the van, Andrew Thomas Gallo, was subsequently arrested and charged with 3 counts each of murder, vehicular manslaughter, felony hit and run, and felony driving under the influence. 2 of the other people in the car occupied by Nick Adenhart also died. Adenhart, who was 22 years old, had started 4 games for the Angels over the past 2 seasons. Following Wednesday night's game, his manager, Mike Socia, had praised the performance of his young pitcher, who seemed to be coming into his own as a major league starter. At a press conference on Thursday, Socia remembered Nick Adenhart as an outstanding young man. It's 19 minutes past the hour. After he'd ridden a 100-1 long shot to victory in the Grand National Sunday in Aintree, England, jockey Liam Treadwell was interviewed by Claire Balding of the BBC. Apparently fascinated with Mr. Treadwell's less than straight and fewer than numerous teeth, Ms. Balding urged Mr. Treadwell to smile into the camera. Then she said he hasn't got the best teeth in the world, but you can afford to go and get them done now if you like. Angry BBC viewers have called for the sacking of Ms. Balding for her insensitivity, but Liam Treadwell's fiancée, Emily Warner, says she and Treadwell took no offense. "I don't think he'd ever change his teeth now anyway," Ms. Warner said. "Liam's quite superstitious, and it could change his luck." I'm Bill Littlefield, ahead on Only a Game, basketball coaching 101 at the site of the women's Final Four. But first, in Augusta, Chad Campbell and Kenny Perry, both 9 under par after 2 rounds, are among the leaders looking over their shoulders at Tiger Woods, who stands at -2. At the other end of the score sheet, 6 over par 78 is no way to start the Masters Golf Tournament if you want to be playing on Saturday and Sunday, and Gary Player won't be. On the other hand, if you're in Augusta to demonstrate that you can still play the course pretty well at the age of 73, 78 on Thursday isn't a bad beginning, and if you're there to say goodbye, it's nothing short of exceptional. Of course, Gary Player should do pretty well on the fabled greensward, given the amount of practice he's had among the bright azaleas and majestic pines. This year's tournament is the 52nd Masters in which he has competed, which is a record, and he has not only competed, he's won the tournament 3 times. That may not sound like much compared to Player's record in the South African Open, which he has won 13 times, or the Australian Open, which he has won 7 times. But even in the days of His Majesty Tiger Woods, majestic in his handling of the putter and the irons as well, 3 Masters jackets mean something. So do his 3 British Open titles, and his victory in the U.S. Open, and his 2 PGA Championship wins. It is exceptionally tempting to poke fun at the Masters, a stubbornly exclusive venue, stuffy even by golf's cobwebbed standards. In an age gone casual, perhaps to a fault, the Masters is tradition, with all the baggage, intimidating and foolish, that goes with that designation. But during the first 2 rounds of this year's event, what fan of the game and what fan of endurance and consistency hasn't found himself or herself smiling at Gary Player's achievement? His numbers on the golf course speak for themselves, but they are not the only relevant numbers. He has raised over $30 million for schools he has established to serve the underprivileged in his native South Africa, where he was once branded a traitor by the South African nationalist government for inviting Arthur Ashe to play tennis and Lee Elder to play golf in his country. Perhaps in part because he has now participated in more Masters tournaments than anybody else, Gary Player has hinted that the current event will be his last. Or maybe he's dropped those hints because, as he said earlier this week, he doesn't like the fact that his tee shots are so short he can hear them land. Yeah, right. He shot an opening round 78 with tee shots like that. No matter, leaving him laughing is never a bad way to make an exit. If Gary Player really is finished at the Masters, future events will be diminished by his absence. Each year, an organization called Black Coaches and Administrators issues report cards that gauge the progress, or lack thereof, in hiring of minority coaches in collegiate sports. The nation's college football programs are most often singled out for criticism, but one group has taken a proactive measure to increase the pool of qualified candidates who may someday patrol women's college basketball sidelines. From St. Louis, Only a Game's Greg Eklund reports.
It's really not that complicated. First thing is this. You're not going to come to the Final Four and get a job. It's not going to happen.
That's Lanika Williams, head basketball coach of The Apprentice School, a Division III school in Newport News, Virginia. 3 years ago, she sat with a handful of other college basketball seniors who completed their basketball eligibility. She participated in the So You Want to Be a Coach program, a feature of the Women's College Basketball Association convention. At last week's convention in St. Louis, Williams was one of 10 head coaches dispensing advice to aspiring basketball coaches.
Another coach isn't going to remember you if you walk up to them and say, hey, I'm such and such. They're like, okay, I'm trying to have a good time. Who are you? You know, everybody knows that you're looking for something. So you're not going to find a job at the Final Four, at least not without the experience to be a seasoned coach. So do not come here looking for a job.
The program is now in its 7th year, and it's held annually in the city of the Women's Final Four. Betty Janes, now a consultant with the WBCA, was the organization's first CEO. She wanted to create a proactive training program because of what she calls a bothersome trend.
Our CEO, Beth Bass, and myself served on a committee with the NCAA trying to figure out ways to give more opportunities to minority women to coach, because the numbers then were terrible.
All 54 attendees at this year's 3-day workshop had to be nominated by their head coach. Oklahoma State head coach Kurt Budke nominated Shontae Smith, one of only 3 players in OSU history to have more than 1,000 points and 800 rebounds. Though Budke says the usually reserved Smith has a lot to learn, she'll succeed in the coaching business.
Oh, I don't think there's any question about that. And she can, because she's a very smart young lady. And once she figures out the game and how kids want to be approached and how much they want to talk on the phone or email or whatever it may be, that you have to be able to communicate.
But we We have an unbelievable panel for you guys.
After 3 days of meetings, mostly at the downtown convention center, Smith remained sure she wants to coach. She feels indebted to the WBCA for providing the means to learn about the business at an early stage.
You know, it's just a blessing and an opportunity for all of us, you know, to have this. I mean, to put, for the coaches and everybody to put this time in here for us to do this is a great opportunity. And just, you know, well, it shows us that it takes hard work and, you know, a lot of qualities to be a coach, but that's the fun thing about it.
But speakers at this year's program, such as Illinois head coach Jolette Law, weren't necessarily emphasizing fun.
In order to be a good head coach, you must be a great assistant. And what that entails is that you must be loyal at all times. Even if you know that your head coach is some of the just off the wall, just having one of those days, you're like, what the, what? It doesn't make any sense to you. And you can go and you go round and round, you can be very opinionated, have your opinion about different things. But when you walk out on that floor and you get with those players, I don't care how crazy it may sound, or how that's just not my values and my morals, you better walk and talk the same language as your head coach.
April Kidd played for Oakland University, Division I mid-major in Rochester, Michigan. As she considers her career choices, she insists that coaching is an option.
Do you get a sense that they're trying to sell the coaching profession, or are they leaving it open for those participating to make up their own minds?
I feel like it's kind of both. I mean, I feel like they're trying to promote young women because you don't see a lot of women coaches. And I think that in our generation, they think we could be something big, and they're just preparing us for the future.
After going through the So You Want to Be a Coach program, Kidd now says she's leaning toward a coaching profession. That would please Betty Janes, who says the number of minority head coaches is gradually increasing, especially among the ranks of assistants.
In the assistant coaches level, it's really increased, and you can tell that if you went to our assistant coaches roundtables. They'll have 700 in there, logically, because just about everybody has anywhere from, you know, 2 to 5 assistants. And I know that our feeling is if that area is really escalating, then the next step will be that those minority coaches then will probably move into a head coaching position.
Welcome to our profession. If you really want to give back and serve and be teachers and coaches, it's a great profession. As long as you understand, it's about the service of giving. So thanks and congratulations. Let's get on with the diplomas.
All right.
DePaul coach Doug Bruno was on hand to present certificates to the 54 participants in this year's program, perhaps unaware that not too far down the road, one or more of them might be looking to replace him on the bench.
All right, class of 2009, April Kidd.
For Only a Game, I'm Greg Eklund in St. Louis.
Alethea Lamberson. Lindsay Kyle.
35 years ago, federal judge Arthur Garrity found that the Boston School Committee had failed to provide minority students with the educational opportunities white students enjoyed. He developed a plan to integrate the schools that were characterized by de facto segregation. Residents of some white neighborhoods demonstrated, sometimes violently, against the busing of black children into the schools their children had been attending. Boston was still racially divided in the fall of 1978 when the Red Sox let a midsummer 14-game lead slip away and lost a 1-game playoff to the Yankees, thanks in part to an improbable home run by light-hitting New York infielder Bucky Dent. In his new book, 78, The Boston Red Sox, A Historic Game and a Divided City, Bill Reynolds explores the relationship between a city and its baseball team at an especially difficult time. Bill Reynolds joins me now in the studio. Bill, welcome back to Only a Game.
Nice to see you, Bill.
During the most violent days of the protests against the busing in Boston, Red Sox left-hander Bill Lee announced to anybody who was listening that Judge Arthur Garrity, who had taken control of the schools away from the Boston School Committee, was the only man in town with any guts What was the reaction in the locker room and around town to that contention?
Well, around town, it was obviously a very controversial statement because it's kind of, I think, safe to say that most people didn't like Garrity. No matter where you were on the busing spectrum, nobody liked Garrity. He had become the symbol of all this. And it's funny, in doing the research for this, League was the only Red Sox person I could find going through all the clips of that summer who mentioned busing. In a public way. I don't think it had a tremendous impact within the clubhouse. I think players, by definition, are kind of insular. But the next night, as Lee tells the story, several guys, three or four guys from the so-called Winter Hill Gang, show up in his house, I think in suburban Stoughton, and are upset. And as Lee told me, he said, I could talk anybody out of anything. So we ended up going out having a few beers. But it was an inflammatory statement.
You discuss what you call a generational clash that was apparent not only in Boston during the 70s, but in baseball as well. What were some of the manifestations of that clash?
Well, I think it was a microcosm of what was going on in the country. You had young versus old. You had anti-war versus pro-war. It was all the remnants of the 60s. It's funny. I think people, when we look back historically, people think that the 60s was the decade that changed America. My contention is that the 70s changed America. The 60s were kind of like outposts. It was kids. It was nowhere near as inclusive. And it's funny, when I did the 67 Red Sox book, now here the Red Sox were in the middle of arguably one of the most dramatic summers in American history. And yet, if you went into that clubhouse back then, it could have been 1957. But if you went into the Red Sox in 1978, you saw the remnants of youth culture, because youth culture now had been mainstreamed everywhere. Mm-hmm. So in this turbulent time when things are changing and mores are changing and everything's kind of changing, you have Don Zimmer, who's the manager, who's the ultimate baseball lifer. And Bill Lee is Bill Lee. It's a personality clash, but most of all, it's a generational clash.
The clash was evident among sports writers as well.
Yeah, because it's funny. And one of the points I try to make in the book is that this was happening when the Boston Globe was becoming arguably the best sports page in America. And they did that by going out and attracting young, obviously talented, educated, intelligent young sports writers and gave them the freedom to be who they were. So many of these writers would go drinking with Bill Lee and several of these players. It all kind of fed off each other. And Bill Lee would say anything, and the writers liked it. They were kind of the same age. They shared a lot of the same opinions on life. And Lee was accessible. I mean, not like in these days when we see them in a very different way and the game's over and it's almost like they're packed in ice someplace. They disappear.
All the history and sociology notwithstanding, I have to say that it was fun to read about that 1978 playoff game between the Yankees and the Red Sox, because whatever else it was certainly an exciting ball game.
Oh, it was a great game. But it was the Red Sox and the Yankees, which always comes wrapped in history and tradition. But also, I think it was the first time that this whole theory that the Red Sox can never win, they'll always break our heart, they're doomed forever, they're beautiful losers, that's when it started, because this was supposed to be the best Red Sox team ever, basically.
Well, and they had that 14-game lead in the middle of the season.
Had a 14-game lead, they had great players, they had pitching, it was going to be their time. And the way they lost it, not only to lose it, but to lose it to Bucky Dent, who became one of the famous bookends of Red Sox infamy. You know, Bucky Dent and Billy Buckner. Mm-hmm. Those are the two signature moments that haunted the franchise and the region until 2004.
I'm speaking with Bill Reynolds, the author of 78, The Boston Red Sox, A Historic Game and a Divided City. You're listening to Only a Game. By the time the Red Sox and the Yankees met for that playoff game in the fall of 1978, the worst of the violence that had followed the busing of schoolchildren in Boston had ended. But still, you write of Boston's fans seeking, and I'm quoting here the word you use, redemption. What sort of redemption did they require?
Well, and so you're a writer too, so I may use the wrong word. So redemption may not be exactly the word. I think that busing wasn't supposed to have happened in Boston. This wasn't Little Rock. It wasn't some southern backwater. This was the Athens of America. I think busing was tremendously psychologically jarring because not only was it an ugly, divisive, horrible thing that went on for too long, it also, in my opinion, it challenged what people thought about Boston. It seemed to me that they needed something, some kind of like reaffirmation that this is, things are going to be okay and we can get through this. And I also think it's the role that baseball, and especially the Red Sox, have always played in New England. It's the one thing that kind of unites everybody, in theory anyway.
Well, that uniting is such an interesting concept to me. As I read 78, your book, I found myself thinking of the lift that some people felt the Yankees could provide New Yorkers back in the fall of 2001, and the lift that some people wanted the New Orleans Saints to give the residents of their city after Katrina. To what extent do you subscribe to that phenomenon of a sports team lifting up the residents of a city out of problems which are obviously much more profound than
sure.
a called strike or a foul
no,
ball?
Sure. I mean, obviously any lift, you can argue, is very transitory. But yet, I think sports, when they work, are one of the few things that kind of at some elemental level unites everybody. And when, it's like when the Patriots are going well and the Red Sox are going well, you can walk into work and you can, if nothing else, stand next to that proverbial water cooler and you can talk to people that you would never talk to. And you can go into a coffee shop and people, it's a common bond. And I mean, you're absolutely right. It's not going to eradicate all the problems, but it makes people at some level deal with one another, feel connected to one another, if only very momentarily.
Bill Reynolds is the author of 78, The Boston Red Sox, A Historic Game and a Divided City. Bill, thank you very much for joining me.
Bill, thank you.
Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent, they won! Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent, Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent, Bucky, Bucky, Bucky Dent, song's done!
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Decorative Museum and Sculpture Park, presenting modern and contemporary sculpture and art on 35 acres, 15 miles from Boston in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Details at decortiva.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There are some promotional stunts to which former athletes should not agree. At the Greektown Casino in Detroit recently, Thomas Hitman Hearns, previously the holder of 7 championship boxing titles, played tic-tac-toe against a chicken named Ginger. You see where this is going, don't you? What does Hearns do if he wins? Crow that he beat a chicken, and if he loses, he hears about it forever. Hey, here's the guy who couldn't beat a chicken at tic-tac-toe. In round one of their epic match, Hearns beat Ginger. The next round ended in a tie, leading the seconds in Hearns' corner to urge their guy to relax and not worry about fouling or a foul, especially one that was a chicken. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, a Merrill Lynch employee with a fallback position in lacrosse. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
I know you're reluctant to spend much time talking about halls of fame, but don't you think the Basketball Hall of Fame is kind of scraping the bottom of the barrel with a class of 2009?
This is one of the best classes to go into a Hall of Fame of any kind ever. Michael Jordan puts it over the top just by himself, but you're also talking about David Robinson and John Stockton, Jerry Sloan, who goes in both for being a coach and a player, and Vivian Stringer. Mm. I mean, this is a great class. As Vivian Stringer put it, she's going in with great, great men of basketball.
As we approach the end of the NBA's regular season, let us talk of home court advantage. More specifically, let us talk of the Cavaliers, who are 38-1 playing in Cleveland. They are the first NBA team to compile 2 15-game winning streaks at home in a season. What a stat that is. Explain, please.
Explain, please. There's one guy on their team who's better than anyone else in the league.
And better at home than anywhere else.
Yeah.
You know, what is the nature of the Cleveland home court advantage? Why is it so much greater than anybody else's?
I don't know, but this is a good indication of enjoy it while you can, Cleveland, because if he does leave, the Cleveland home court advantage goes with him. I do like the fact that he's relaxing at the ends of games now when the games are out and he's on the bench. LeBron James gets up and plays a little air guitar.
All right, Charlie, I'm an NBA team. I sold out 22 games this season. I don't need any money, but I want the league to lend me many millions in case I might need some later on. Which team am I?
You are the New Orleans Hornets. And what a great thing. Free money? Yes, me some too.
Me some too, whether I need it or not.
That's right. To be fair, there are certain climactic conditions involving a team in New Orleans that we have sad reason to remember. And if there's any team that has to armor itself against contingencies and vagaries and so forth, it's probably the New Orleans Hornets.
Jim Calhoun announced on Thursday that he will return to UConn next season. That would be his 24th season at the school. Given the current investigation of possible recruiting violations with that men's program in Stores, what do you think the chances are he makes it to opening night for
season 24?
He'll
be there. I think he's decided this is the way to brazen it out, and he's going to come back. I hope his health remains good. I'm a little bit surprised that he didn't walk in the sunset, and I'm not entirely sure he wouldn't have had Connecticut managed to win the national championship this year.
As you mentioned last week, the University of Connecticut women's basketball team is exceptional. They won the NCAA championship on Tuesday night. They finished their run at 39-0. They beat every team they played this year by double digits, which no other team had done. So, best ever?
There are Connecticut basketball fans that will tell you that there are a couple of earlier teams that could have beaten this one. I don't know. I think you've got to go back to the very first UCLA team with the then Lou Alcindor to have a college basketball season that compares with this one. As you said, they won all 39 games. They won them all by double digits, and usually by pretty big double digits.
Absolutely. They beat ranked teams by 25 points regularly. I'm sure lots of people who attend Mets games this season will enjoy Citi Field, the team's new stadium. Unhappily, the group of people may not include as many youngsters as it did in the old days of humble Shea. Why not?
Well, because the Youth Day games that were usually done for Little Leaguers, what used to be 1,200 seats is now 500, and what used to be $13 seats discounted to $9 will now be undiscounted at $19. Welcome to the real world, Little Leaguers.
Undiscounted is a splendid term for the entire
operation. It's a nice way of saying full price.
If the first two baseball games in Toronto are any indication, this may not be the best season to bring the family to a Blue Jays game. What's gotten into fans at the Rogers Center?
I know, they've gone a little nutty. People are throwing things on the field, and the Rogers Center in Toronto on Tuesday went completely dry. Beer and alcohol was banned for the Jays game against the Tigers by the local gaming commission due to past infractions at the ballpark, which I presume means giving it to people who are not of age.
Well, wet or dry and throwing things or not, it worked. The Blue Jays are off to a 3-0 start last time I looked.
I don't know what else they can take away.
We're in day three of the Masters Tournament, and nestled snugly between stories of Tiger Woods' triumphs and Gary Player's final Masters after an amazing 52 appearances is the story of John Daly's return to Augusta. How should we feel about that?
He's outside selling his wares out of what appears to be a very large traveling bus. He's selling his Lion clothing lines. He's, of course, in the middle of a suspension for 6 months from the PGA Tour, which he says he's been working on his game and his physique. But he's at the Masters outside a jewelry store last year. He's going up in the world. Last year he was outside a Hooters. Everybody's got to make a living, Bill.
In his ongoing attempt to establish an unbreakable record for number of national soccer teams coached, Bora Milutinovic has taken a new job, and it's a challenging one, don't you think?
Yes, he's going to coach Iraq's national team. He's coached five different teams at the World Cup. I didn't know that. I mean, I know he coached the United States and Mexico. The last time he coached was Jamaica, but they let him go 2 years ago on a contract dispute. Who's his boss in the Iraq Football Association? Do we have any idea? Because it used to be Saddam Hussein's kids.
That's right. That's right. On May 1st, the Hollywood Wax Museum will auction off over 200 wax figures, including those of famous athletes. So, can I put you down for a Hulk Hogan maybe a wax Jordan?
See, I understand a lot of these. I mean, Tiger Woods, Michael Jordan, Joe Montana, Muhammad Ali. I understand that. Mark McGuire, I don't know. Depends what's in the wax, I suppose. But Hulk Hogan? Proof positive that against all meteorological and astrological and astronomical odds, you can wax and wane at the same time.
And finally, Charlie, it was reported this week that Boston's Lyric Little Bandbox is going to host an outdoor hockey game on New Year's Day next. How do you like the possibility of the Bruins hosting, oh, say, the Canadians at Fenway Park?
Oh, I'm gonna tell you, there are going to be a lot of seats at the Lyric Little Icebox where you can't really see the action, but it's going to be great television, which is what this thing is meant to be from the start. And it's got to be the Canadians. At the very least, it's got to be the Rangers. It's got to be an Original Six game. They can't bring Tampa Bay or Florida or somebody in here to do this.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Steve Fine, who listens to Only a Game on Vermont Public Radio, emailed this week in response to Charlie Pierce's invocation during last week's program of prominent socialist Eugene V. Debs, who died in 1926, and Big Bill Hayward, a much persecuted organizer and force in the International Workers of the World. He died in Moscow in 1928. Their names came up in our discussion of the Unemployment Olympics held recently in New York's Tompkins Park. I have to suspect these references may not have been understood by too many of your listeners, Mr. Fine wrote. I suspect that besides myself, the only other listener who understood the reference to Bill Hayward is a very elderly gentleman now retired in Cleveland who listens to your show constantly and who was, for many years, a full-time wobbly organizer. He must have been pretty excited to hear Big Bill mentioned on the air and to know that Bill is remembered so fondly. It was great. John Luskowski, who listens to Only a Game, courtesy of WITF in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, feels that we've slighted his state. I was disappointed that you did not mention Penn State and their significant first championship at the NIT, he wrote. Three segments on the Yankees, uncalled for. Mr. Luskowski, we had a story about the two new ballparks in New York, only one of which is occupied by the Yankees. I talked with a guy who's written a book about Roger Clemens, who pitched for Boston, Toronto, and Houston, as well as New York. In my conversation with baseball analyst Tim Kirkchin, he devoted more time to the Padres, the Cubs, and, yes, the Phillies, than he did to either team in New York. I counted. Finally, in response to our story about Senator John McCain's attempt to achieve a presidential pardon for deceased boxing champion Jack Johnson, John D. Craik wrote, "Your story was interesting as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Why has it taken so long for a pardon effort to materialize? Why is John McCain taking the lead on this? What's the proverbial rest of the story?" Even before Ken Burns got to the subject several years ago, much had been written about the trials of Jack Johnson. Perhaps only various past legislators and presidents could tell us why he remains unpardoned. You can reach us with your comments through our website, onlyagame.org. You can leave a comment on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860, or you can write us at Only a Game, WBUR, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215. And now for something completely different, a man who works in the Treasury Department of Merrill Lynch in Manhattan and sees in the current ongoing economic tumble a blessing.
If it was real busy, I don't think I'd be able to find the time to go work out and stuff during lunch. So.
Greg Downing, whose job is to make sure various trades at Merrill Lynch are completed smoothly, made that observation during a recent weekday as he was returning to the office with a sandwich that he'd eat at his desk, having used up his lunch hour at a gym in Jersey City. Downing's noon workouts are necessary to the satisfactory performance of his second job. He's a transition player, sort of like a midfielder, for the Boston Blazers indoor lacrosse team. Late last Saturday afternoon, having made the commute from New York to Boston for that evening's game against the Buffalo Bandits, one of Boston's rivals in the National Lacrosse League, Greg Downing dropped his equipment bag near the door to the Blazers' office across the street from the TD Bank North Garden, neatly folded his suit jacket on the table in the conference room, and told me that making the transition from Wall Street to his weekend job, which involves getting hit a lot with a stick, is no problem.
You know, I've kept it kind of so it's just absolutely separate from work, but you do make a lot of connections just through, you know, the people that you play with. Also, it's a good conversation starter, really, if someone does find out you do play this on the side. My boss, really, he actually enjoys the fact that I do this. So, I mean, it is good to make connections and stuff, but I haven't been using it like that.
Impressed, Greg Downing acknowledges that while he's enjoyed learning the ropes in the financial world, even today's diminished version of the financial world, his real passion is lacrosse.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't want to tell that to my boss in New York. I don't know. It's kind of great to, you know, have that on one side and kind of get away from that whole world and come to this job. I guess it's a good way to just kind of forget about what happened during the week and, you know, kind of focus on the weekend stuff. So we've been, you know, having a lot of people lose jobs and stuff, and it's kind of tough, you know, seeing that when I have, you know, two jobs and someone's losing theirs.
Some of Downing's colleagues at Merrill Lynch in these difficult days are doubtless dealing with their stress on squash courts or jogging paths or surrounded by dark paneling in their country clubs while the ice clinks musically in their glasses. Greg Downing has opted for a somewhat more raucous venue. Fans of ice hockey and basketball games will know that standard practice during those games is to cut the music when play resumes after a timeout. Not so with indoor lacrosse, where all the action is accompanied by a soundtrack, perhaps to help fill the building. As he watched last Saturday evening's game between the Blazers and the Bandits, Blazers owner Doug Refew discussed his sport and the place men like Greg Downing, who's paid about $10,000 a season to play indoor lacrosse, have in it.
This is like a throwback to the 1930s, 1940s with some of the major sports leagues where the players needed to work a second job in order to make ends meet. Greg's got a great career on Wall Street, but he's a great, very important player to us, so we've made a decision to stand behind him and get him up here for the games and in and out. It's not easy on him, but he does his best he can to support both sides of his life.
Number six, take your seat. Buffalo Penalties under the six, 2 minutes for cross-checking.
From his perch in the owner's box, which just hours earlier had served as an expensive seat for fans of the Boston Bruins, Doug Refew surveyed his temporary domain, which appeared to be a little less than a third full. As the owner of an indoor lacrosse team, the core of which consists of Canadians living for the season in a house owned by the Blazers, he faces challenges peculiar to startup operations and must compromise accordingly. Would he like all of his players to come to each practice? Of course he would. Does he recognize that some of them, like Greg Downing, owe allegiance to their day jobs? Yes, he does.
We make draft choices. We make trades sometimes based on geography. That's something that doesn't happen with the Patriots, I can imagine. So yeah, I think with a guy like that, we made a decision that this guy was disciplined enough. He has a passion for lacrosse, and he has kept the candle lit on both ends and held up his end of that bargain.
Indoor lacrosse players perform in short bursts, jumping in and out of the game more frequently than ice hockey players changing lines, so it's difficult to gauge how well an individual player is doing while the game's in progress. The goals are smaller than the goals in field lacrosse, which is played outdoors on a soccer pitch or a football field, so scoring indoors is a challenge. In the previous night's game, Greg Downing, who is a rookie with the Blazers, fired in his first two goals of the season. On this night against the Bandits, he got credit for just one assist as Buffalo wore the host Blazers down.
Buffalo goal.
Boston's early leads of 5-1 and 6-2 eventually disintegrated. They lost to the first-place Bandits 15-11. Outside the locker room, as he prepared to once again make the transition from pro lacrosse player to facilitator of commercial trades at Merrill Lynch, Greg Downing acknowledged that it would be a dreary commute back to New York.
However I get back, whether it be train or plane, it just kind of dwells on me the whole time. I think about all the little mistakes I made and what could have been, you know what I mean? So it's definitely more frustrating with a loss.
Greg Downing's New York job makes it impossible for him to join his Blazers teammates for midweek practices, but he will be arriving in Boston again shortly for tonight's game at the TD Bank North Garden against the Rochester Nighthawks. The Blazers will finish the regular season the following week with a rematch against the Bandits in Buffalo, at which point it will be almost time for Greg Downing to begin thinking about the commute to his next part-time seasonal job with a field lacrosse team.
Well, I did play for a team that was out of Los Angeles, and now they actually four of the teams folded with the economy and the owners kind of bailed out. So there's six teams now. They put me on the Denver team.
Denver? New York to Boston on the weekend, I could understand, but how was he going to manage to be a weekend warrior in Colorado while monitoring trades in New York?
Well, I did it last year with L.A., so I figure it's maybe an hour and a half shorter of a flight, so we'll be able to do it.
Able, yes, and willing, certainly, no doubt about that. In fact, this is a guy who says he can't imagine not competing at lacrosse. And if just thinking about Greg Downing's peripatetic summer after his winter with both Merrill Lynch and the Blazers makes you tired, consider the key number in this story. It's not goals or assists. It's not miles traveled per week. It's Greg Downing's age. He's 24. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Brian Fadham and from John Kalish. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you'd like to view our photo galleries, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word is from Helene Elliott. I asked our venerable hockey analyst, if you were a betting woman, would you wager on the NHL putting a franchise in Las Vegas?
Yeah, I'd go to Vegas to bet on it not happening.
Yeah? Okay, I'll take the City of Lights and the points, whatever that means. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.